Welcome back, everyone, to the channel. Tonight's terrifying story, we have a first-person's account, a park ranger in the state of Minnesota in the Midwest, about the cover-ups and these horrifying things that are being kept secret from the public. What are these things that are being kept secret? Well, some of them will be exposed tonight, but some we may not have answers for. Make sure to like, comment, and subscribe if you're new, share with your friends, and spread me like butter. I hope you enjoy. I've worked for the National Park Service for 23 years now. Long enough to see the wilderness take more from people than it even gives back. Most of the time, the mountains and forests of the upper Midwest are quiet. They hum with wind through trees, the rustle of deer, the low tremor of loons across a lake. But sometimes, the stillness feels wrong, like the woods are holding their breath. I started at this park, one I won't name for reasons that will become obvious, back in 1999. Minnesota has hundreds of thousands of acres of unbroken forest, old growth so dense it could swallow a man whole. The lakes here sit black under the canopy, colder than you would think for summer. It's the kind of place where a compass is useless, and cell service drops off miles before the trailhead. That isolation used to calm me. Now it makes my skin crawl. The first time I realized something wasn't right, it was the summer of 2015. A college kid from Duluth vanished. He had gone out on a solo backpacking trip, just a weekend loop near the northern boundary. His car was still at the trailhead when his father reported him missing. We searched for 10 days. Found his tent flattened by a fallen limb, his pack unzipped, food scattered, but no tracks leading away. No human ones, anyways. That's where the stories start. The kind the service doesn't like circulating. The local rangers whisper about things in the trees, shapes moving just beyond the beams of headlamps. I used to laugh it off. Stress, exhaustion, imagination. But the longer I worked in those woods, the more I realized the stories didn't drift in from drunks or campers. They came from my own team. I kept my head down, wrote my reports, followed the procedures. Missing persons are part of the job. We don't talk about the patterns, the odd similarities between cases, because the service tells us not to. Do not speculate. Do not cause panic. That's the line they always feed us. Then came 2019. That's the year everything changed. It started in early August. Unseasonably hot. Mosquitoes thick as rain. We got a call from dispatch. A family had reported their son, mid-30s, experienced, overdue by 48 hours. His name's not important. None of them are, in the end. He had been staying at a primitive campsite north of a remote lake, accessible only by a fire road and a 2-mile portage trail. When I arrived at the staging area, his car was there, dusted in pine pollen, hood still warm. That meant he had been back recently, maybe within a day. His camping permit showed check-in for 3 nights. But he never checked out. The trail to his site cut through dense spruce and birch, the kind of growth that blocks out the sun. You could walk that path at noon and feel like it's twilight. There's a smell in those woods. Wet iron moss and the faint rot of things unseen. It clings to your clothing. Half a mile in, I noticed something odd. The usual forest sounds, the chatter of squirrels, the tapping of woodpeckers gone. I could only hear my own boots in the duff and the slow pulse of blood in my ears. That silence isn't natural. When prey animals vanish, it's because they know a predator's nearby. At the site, I found his tent still standing, his pack leaning against the tree unzipped, a half-eaten energy bar laid in the dirt beside it. Nothing disturbed, no sign of a struggle. But on the trunk above the pack, someone or something had raked deep gouges into the bark. Three parallel lines, each about a foot long. Too wide for claws, too deep for a knife. I photographed everything, logged it, called in backup. When my partner, a ranger named, well, we'll call her D, showed up, she stared at the marks for a long time before saying, "Bear, maybe?" I wanted to believe that. Bears happen. But the spacing didn't fit. Neither did the angle. The gouges started 5 feet off the ground and ended near 7. We followed a faint game trail heading north. 20 minutes in, the smell hit us. Copper and decay. Dee thought it may be an animal carcass, but we never found the source. The odor just faded. We turned back when the lights started to go. I'll never forget the feeling walking out of there, like something was behind us, matching our pace, just outside the beam of my headlamp. I kept turning, but all I saw was the trees and mist. The service sent a full search crew the next morning. Dogs, drones, the works. We found nothing. No body, no footprints, no gear beyond what I had seen. The file was quietly closed 2 weeks later as presumed fatal misadventure. But here's the thing. A week after that, the man's cell phone pinged a tower nearly 50 miles south of his last known location. Impossible distance on foot. Maybe not impossible on a regular street, but especially through untracked forest, absolutely. The service flagged it as a technical error. But I knew better. In September, another disappearance. Then another. By November, we logged 5 in the same quadrant. Experienced hikers, all gone without a trace. The official stance was environmental factors, unstable terrain, predators, hyperthermia. I remember the meeting. Late afternoon, conference room in the main station. The superintendent, an older man who had spent 30 years in the service, closed the blinds before he spoke.
"These stories are hurting tourism," he said. "No speculation, no media contact, no ghost stories."
Someone in the back asked about the claw marks, about the missing organs in one of the recovered animals we had found during the search. An elk, gutted clean but untouched otherwise. It was completely hollow. The superintendent just stared at him.
"That's need to know," he said.
After the meeting, Dee pulled me aside. She looked pale, exhausted.
"You've heard of the Wendigo, right?"
she asked. I told her not to start with that folklore nonsense.
But she shook her head. "It's not just stories. My grandfather was Ojibwe. He used to say the Wendigo hunts the greedy. But what if it's something more than that?"
"Or simply it's just hungry," I said, just joking. Even though I was joking, deep down inside, part of me knew that she probably wasn't wrong.
Winter came early that year. By mid-November, the lakes were sheathing over with ice, and the night sank below zero. Normally, that means the missing person reports drop off. Fewer hikers, fewer risks. But even as the snow came down, people kept vanishing. 3 cases in 4 weeks. All in the same general area. A cluster of drainages and ridges north of the main campground where the map just listed Restricted Service Zone. I started noticing the pattern after the 3rd one. I was reviewing the search reports, comparing GPS coordinates, when I realized the grid squares overlapped almost perfectly. The strange part was the closure orders. Every time a disappearance occurred, that section of the forest would get temporarily restricted for safety evaluation. But no results ever came back for those evaluations. At first, I thought maybe the service was covering up for bears, or even wolves, protecting tourism revenue by keeping incidents quiet. But when I looked deeper, the timing didn't fit. These weren't peak predation months, and every one of the disappearances had occurred within a week of a new moon. Coincidence? Maybe. Or maybe something that didn't like being seen. I told Dee about it over coffee in the break room one morning. She stared at me for a moment, then said,
"You're starting to feel it too."
"Feel what?" I asked. She didn't answer right away. She glanced towards the closed office door, then lowered her voice.
"There are reports that don't file with the public logs. Ranger incidents. We have our own archives, but only supervisors can access them."
I laughed it off. But that afternoon, I used my credentials to log into the internal system anyway. And there it was. A section marked Field Irregularities, Internal Review Only. There were dozens of entries. Descriptions that didn't make sense. Auditory anomaly? Deep vocalization? Non-bear? Thermal signature? Bipedal? 2 meters? Unidentified howling? Triangulated source unrecorded? The oldest entries went back to 1978. That night, I sat in my truck outside the ranger station long after everyone left. Snow fell thick and silent over the windshield. I kept thinking about the word bipedal. The next morning, Dee called me on the radio before dawn.
"You should come see this,"
she said. She was stationed near the North Fire Road, about 2 miles from the last known disappearance. When I arrived, she was kneeling beside a patch of snow that had been disturbed. Footprints. Large. Human-like. Bare. You could see the outline of toes, long and splayed, and a deep heel strike. The stride length was almost 4 feet. Too long for any ordinary man. Too deliberate for a hoax in weather that cold. We followed for maybe 50 yards before they veered off into a dense undergrowth. Then they just stopped. No break in the pattern. No return tracks. Just vanished. Dee then whispered,
"Tell me that's not human."
I wanted to, but the truth was, I didn't know anymore. Later, back at headquarters, I tried to log the tracks into the database. The system froze. When I restarted it, the entry field was gone. I checked with IT, and they said the category for unconfirmed tracks had been archived and disabled the previous week, per regional directive. That's when it hit me. We weren't just being told to ignore it. We were being prevented from documenting it, too. A few nights later, I drove up to the restricted zone myself. I wasn't supposed to, but curiosity, or maybe obsession, had gotten the better of me. The moon was new again, the forest dark as ink. The only sound was the crunch of snow under my boots and the hum of the truck engine cooling behind me. The air had that strange metallic bite it gets when something's watching. If you had ever been alone in the deep woods, you know the feeling. When every tree seems to lean closer, every shadow feels alive. I parked at the old service gate and started hiking in. The wind had picked up, carrying the faint smell of rot and pine. After a mile, I came to a clearing I didn't recognize. A circle maybe 30 feet across, completely bare of snow, perfectly circular. My flashlight beam caught something glinting near the center. It was a trail marker. One of ours, bent backwards like soft metal. Around it were impressions in the soil. Not quite footprints, more like something had pressed its weight into the ground with inhuman strength. That's when I heard it. The low hum. Almost below hearing, like a growl carried through the trees. It didn't sound like any animal I knew. Too deep, too resonant. Every instinct told me to leave. I did. I didn't run, but I didn't look back either. When I got back to my truck, I found fresh snow on the hood, and on it, a long smear like a handprint. Fingers ending in what looked like points. I didn't report that either. Outside of D, who would believe me? By January, we had 12 disappearances. Of course, you won't find that in any news report. Then, suddenly, the reports just stopped. The park closed sections for winter safety. When I asked about reopening searches in spring, my supervisor simply said, "Those files are sealed. HQ's handling it." I could tell he was lying. He wouldn't meet my eyes. Dee took leave shortly after that. She said that she was going home for a while to clear her head. She never came back. Transfer papers arrived 2 months later, reassigned to a completely different region. I stayed. I don't know why. Maybe because I felt like I owed those people something. Maybe because I wanted answers. Maybe both. Through March, I kept hiking out to that same section. The snow melted, the ground turned to mud, and the forest seemed to breathe again. But that silence never left. No birdsong, no insects, just the whisper of wind through dead branches. One morning, I found what looked like drag marks near the edge of a frozen pond. Two parallel grooves about 8 inches apart, leading into the water. At the edge, the ice had been shattered inward, like something had gone through. No footprints nearby. That night, I dreamt of voices in the trees. My name whispered low, like someone standing just behind me. When I woke, my tent zipper was half open. The service says the woods can be unpredictable, that people vanish because nature is cruel. But nature doesn't move in patterns like this. Nature doesn't erase evidence. I can't shake the thought that something old had learned how to stay hidden because we helped it. Later in spring, the snow retreated like it didn't want to let go. Black patches of ice clinging to the shadows beneath pine roots. By April, most of the park roads were still half frozen mud, the kind that can swallow a tire if you linger. Normally, spring feels like renewal up here. New fawns, fresh runoff, the world thawing back to life. But that year, it felt wrong. The air carried a weight, like the forest itself was holding on to something. In early May, a field volunteer from the Boundary Trail radioed in an unusual find. She sounded shaken, stumbling over her own words.
"You'll want to see this," she said. "There's... I don't know what it is."
I drove out with another ranger. We'll call him Jay. One of the new hires, fresh out of training. The kid believed in the system, in the idea that we could explain everything if we just follow procedure. I envied that. The coordinates led us about 4 miles off the main route, down a maintenance path we rarely used. Fallen birch blocked most of it. The volunteer was waiting near the tree line, pale, arms folded tight against the cold. She didn't say much, just pointed. About 20 yards beyond her, the forest opened into a small clearing I didn't recognize. The soil there was torn up, gouges like something heavy had churned through the mud. In the center was a mound of leaves and sticks. At first, I thought it was a beaver cache, or maybe a bear den collapse. But when I got closer, I realized the arrangement wasn't random. The branches were stacked in deliberate angles, woven together into a sort of half dome. Too structured for windfall. Jay crouched beside it, brushing dirt away with his glove. "You see this?" he said, pointing at the base. "Looks almost arranged." He was right. The sticks were anchored into the ground with a circular pattern. Not quite a nest. Not quite a shelter. I lifted one of the branches. It came loose too easily. Beneath it, the smell hit me. Metallic, old, sweet in a way that turns your stomach. Jay stepped back, coughing.
"Oh, dead animal?"
I didn't answer. I pulled another layer of branches aside. Beneath them, half buried in mud, was a torn strip of nylon, bright red, sun faded. Tent fabric. And beside it, something worse. A hiking boot. The same brand issued to the missing hiker's photos from the last year's case file. No bones, no flesh, just remnants. But the area around the site was wrong, too clean, too controlled.
like something had placed those items there deliberately. We marked the coordinates, took photos, radioed the find. Protocol said to leave it undisturbed until investigators arrived. But as we hiked back to the vehicles, I couldn't shake the feeling that we were being followed. Every time we paused, the forest paused too. When I looked over my shoulder, I caught glimpses, movement where there shouldn't be. The color of bark shifting just enough to trick the eye. That night, I barely slept. I kept hearing faint knocks outside the cabin, rhythmic, spaced out. 3 beats, then silence. I told myself it was the wind, but when I checked in the morning, there were indentations in the soil near the steps. Not prints exactly, more like impressions. Toes elongated, splayed, pressing deep into the earth. The service sealed off the site by noon the next day. Wildlife hazard, they said. Only a handful of us knew what was really there. I wasn't invited to the follow-up briefing, but Jay was. When he came out, he looked pale. They said it was a bear cache, he muttered, like he didn't believe it himself. That's the official statement. A bear cache doesn't weave branches. A bear doesn't leave hiking gear stacked in ritualistic patterns. Over the next few weeks, they brought up cleanup teams. They called them contractors, but none of them wore any park insignia. Black trucks, tinted windows, no plates. They hauled off debris in sealed barrels, refused to make eye contact. When I asked who they reported to, my supervisor told me to drop it. It's handled, he said. Let it go. But I couldn't. That's when I started digging into the archives again, the parts of the system that weren't meant to be accessed. I used an old clearance code from a regional director who had retired years ago. Inside, I found a directory of closed cases marked Restricted Biological Anomalies. The earliest was from 1956. A ranger team reported discovering a partial human skeleton suspended in pine canopy at 20 feet up. The conclusion? Bear predation. Misidentified due to decomposition. Another from 1971. 2 hunters located deceased under anomalous conditions. Remains elevated in conifer limbs. No climb marks or tracks. And another from 1994, less than 2 miles from where we had found the woven structure. Unidentified cry heard near camp at 0200. Responding ranger reports auditory hallucination and severe disorientation. Area closed until further notice. The same coordinates appeared again and again. I printed everything. That night, I laid the maps and files across my cabin table, tracing the points with a pencil. They formed a rough arc, following the line of a ridge that locals call the Silent Bend. An old fire road used to cut through there before it was abandoned. If you overlay the cases on a topographic map, every disappearance sits within a half-mile radius of that road. I decided to go back alone. Maybe it was stubbornness, maybe guilt, but I needed to see it again, the clearing, the structure, the silence. The park had officially reopened by then, but that section remained closed due to trail maintenance. I drove in after dark, parked at the locked gate and hiked the rest. The air was thick with the smell of thawing earth and something else, faint metallic-like rust. When I reached the clearing, the mound was gone. The soil had been raked smooth. But in the center, something new. A circle of stones, perfectly arranged. Inside it, a single object. A ranger badge. Old, tarnished. The number stamped into it didn't match any current employee. I crouched to look closer, and that's when the woods went dead quiet. No wind, no distant creak of trees, absolutely nothing. Then, movement at the edge of the clearing. Tall, incredibly thin, the shape of a man, but wrong. Were those antlers? It stood too still. The air around it seemed to ripple slightly, like heat off asphalt. I blinked, and it was gone. Just shadows again. I backed away slow, keeping my light steady, or as steady as possible. The forest didn't move. It watched. When I finally made it back to the road, I realized I had been walking in circles. My GPS showed I had only moved a quarter mile in 2 hours. That's not possible. Back at the cabin, I stared at that old badge under my desk lamp. The number was partially worn, but the last two digits were 56. The same year as the earliest restricted file. Someone had been here before me. Someone who didn't make it out. I locked the badge in my drawer and told no one. But that night, I heard it again. The rhythmic knocking. 3 beats, then silence. Then scratching noises. Only this time, it seemed closer. By late July, the park looked alive again. Tourists filled the visitor center, families crowded the lake's edges, and the trees wore their green like nothing had ever happened. But under that surface, the quiet was still there. The kind that presses on the inside of your skull when you stop talking long enough to notice it. I'd been transferred, technically. Paperwork said I was on seasonal reassignment to a nearby district. But I still lived in the same ranger housing. Still woke every night to that sense that something was waiting outside the window. Paranoid? Maybe. Every creak of the wood frame made my hand twitch towards the flashlight on the nightstand. By then, I'd stopped sleeping well. Dreams of the clearing came almost every night. The stones, the old badge, the shape that shimmered just beyond the beam of my light. I'd wake up to the smell of rust in my nose and the certainty that something had moved while I slept. I tried to ignore it, to let it fade the way bad memories do. But the feeling didn't fade. It sharpened. Early August, a thunderstorm rolled through. One of those long, slow Midwest storms that leaves the air charged and humming. Power flickered, radios went down. Around midnight, the dispatcher called. A small fire had been reported near the northern boundary. The same zone still technically closed for maintenance. No one else was available. Against every rational thought I had, I volunteered to check it out. The drive took an hour. By the time I reached the old surface gate, the storm had passed, leaving a heavy mist. The headlights cut only a few yards ahead. The world narrowed to silver fog and black trees. I parked, grabbed my pack, and started walking. The beam of my flashlight caught raindrops like sparks. I could hear water dripping from the canopy, steady as a clock. Half a mile in, the air changed, warmer, almost electric. And then the smell hit, the same metallic tang I had smelled months earlier. I swept the light across the trees. The bark was dark and slick, almost wet, but when I reached out, my fingers came away dry. The mist shifted. For a moment, I thought I saw something tall standing just off the path. I blinked and it was gone. I told myself to keep moving. I repeated procedure in my head. Locate source, mark coordinates, report back. But the forest wasn't right. The trail that should have led to the ridge veered off to an unfamiliar angle. The undergrowth looked disturbed, trampled in long, uneven strides. I followed them until the path opened into a clearing. It was exactly as I'd left it, except for one thing. The circle of stones was gone. In its place, a shallow pit, freshly dug. The soil was damp and dark, as if something had been buried and then uncovered again. I crouched, shining my light across it. The bottom wasn't empty. Something glinted there, metal, half buried. I brushed the dirt away and froze. It was a badge. The one I'd locked in my dresser drawer. That's when the forest exhaled. Every branch seemed to shiver at once. The air went still and thick. I could see my own breathing, too loud, too fast. Then, behind me, the sound I'll never forget, the knock. Three slow beats echoing through the trees. I turned. The beam of my flashlight shook across the trunks, the fog swirling like smoke. Between two birches, maybe 20 yards away, something moved. Upright, pale, thin, tall. For a heartbeat, I thought it was a man. Then it stepped forward. The shape was lean but wrong. The shoulders too narrow, the limbs too long, the posture almost human, but not quite. Its eyes caught the light. Not reflection, but glow dull red, like embers buried in ash. It didn't lunge, it didn't snarl, it just stood there. I tried to speak, to say something, anything, but my voice didn't work. Every nerve in my body screamed to run, but some part of me, deep down, felt something else. Like I had seen it before. It tilted its head. Its movement was slow. Almost intelligent, maybe. Then, in the space of a blink, it just simply disappeared. The forest erupted, branches snapping, leaves thrashing, air compressing around me. I stumbled backwards, tripped, and hit the ground hard. The flashlight spun away, beams slicing through the fog. For a second, I saw its outline again, further off, melting back into the trees. I don't remember running, only the sound of my boots slamming the trail, the rasp of my breath, and the sense that every step I took was being mirrored just behind me. When I had reached the gate, the mist ended like a wall. The world on the other side felt normal again. Rain, wind, the distant hum of a highway.
By the time I had reached the truck, dawn was breaking. Time seemed to have been lost. The sky was pale, the kind of gray that makes everything look drained. I sat there for a long time, shaking, waiting for the sun to burn through the fog. When I finally drove back to headquarters, the badge was gone from my drawer, and I never saw it again. The service logged my report as a false alarm, atmospheric distortion. They said the fire was a lightning strike that never spread. The area remained closed for soil restoration. But a week later, new signage went up along the park boundary. No official announcement, just fresh metal plates that read, "No entry beyond this point. Biological hazard containment." No one asked me what I saw. No one ever does. The tourists still come. Families still take photos beside the lakes, not realizing how close the wilderness presses in behind them. The stories fade with each new season, replaced by the next new cycle, the next distraction. But every now and then, when the weather turns and the wind comes down from the ridges, the radios pick up something strange. A low hum, almost below hearing, followed by three slow knocks. And sometimes, if you're standing alone near the tree line at dusk, you could feel it. That breath of warm air from the shadows, like something old, remembering your scent.